a Ukrainian commander in Severodonetsk says that his forces are fighting in the streets to counter Russia's artillery advantage.
Russian army is not that good in street fighting, and especially when they are not on their territories.
Plus, U.S. officials say they're helping move Ukrainian grain to Africa. But is that enough to stop the continent from purchasing Russian grains?
Yeah, Africans don't really care where they're going to get their food from. And this is particularly so because there is no alternative that has been offered thus far to try and to mitigate some of the consequences of this conflict.
And later in the program, we meet a Ukrainian YouTuber sharing life in the conflict. Today is Friday, June 10th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Miller. Heavy fighting continues to be reported in the eastern city of Severodonetsk. That's the small city that has become the focus of Russia's advance and the site of one of the bloodiest battles in the war. On Friday, the Ukrainian commander says that his forces there are fighting in the streets to counter Russia's artillery advantage. I spoke with reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv to get the details.
This war, at this point at least, it's an artillery war. And what we know from the official announcements is that Ukraine and basically losing Russia in terms of the amount of artillery ammunition and artillery systems that Ukraine has. So basically it's one artillery system for 10 or 15 Russian artillery installations. So this basically creating new ways of fighting. And this is true that the Ukrainian army is trying to get Russians into the street fightings, because what intelligence says and also what a lot of military experts say, that Russian army is not that good in street fightings, and especially when they are not on their territory, so they don't know the city that well. Basically, if we talk about the city of Severodonetsk, it's quite, you know, it's quite complicated.
And I wanted to ask you about that artillery fighting, because on Friday, Ukraine also asked for additional artillery. This is after both the United States and the United Kingdom pledged to send more.
Basically, the main point for you from the Ukrainian side is that Ukraine needs as much as possible now, not later, because again, as what we already mentioned, that Russia for the moment is leading in terms of the amount of artillery installations they have. So it's like 10 or 15 times more that they have. And Ukraine uses from 5,000 to 6,000 artillery shells every day. And basically, Ukraine really needs this long-range systems in order to increase the, you know, the attack on the artillery system of Russia and to make it more successful and quicker, you know. So this is the only reason why Ukraine is just, you know, continue to remind the West. And of course, we also understand that Ukrainian servicemen, they need some time to learn how to use these systems.
Anna, and one last question. The British Defense Ministry said on Friday that they are concerned about a potential cholera outbreak in Mariupol. What can you share with us about how they made that assessment?
The first information about cholera, possible cholera outbreak, appeared, I think, last week through the intelligence service of Ukraine. During the, you know, the hacking of military channels, they heard that Russian forces are discussing that cholera is becoming a problem. So basically, the first name of this infection started to appear, you know, in their speeches and between each other in the calls. So Ukrainians and basically Ukrainians started to, together with partners, started to discover this more and more. As we know, Mariupol is like 90% destroyed, and a lot of bodies still remain under the ruins of the buildings. And now it's some. And it's really hot now in Ukraine, like this past couple of weeks. So, of course, you know, all these bodies around this the city, and all the problems with medical system in Mariupol, with water supply, with electricity that remain, it, of course, makes additional problem for, especially in terms of this kind of disease.
Anna Chernikova is reporting from Kyiv, Ukraine. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Russia and China on Friday unveiled the first road bridge between the two countries as Moscow pivots to Asia amid its confrontation with the West over Ukraine. A kilometer-long bridge of the Amur River links the far eastern Russian city of Blagoveshchensk with Heihe in northern China. The construction of the bridge was completed 2 years ago, but the inauguration was postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. And in other developments, the West has denounced the death sentences for 3 men who fought for Ukraine. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma continues our coverage.
Ukraine and other nations have called a pro-Moscow court's sentencing of 2 British citizens and a Moroccan to death for fighting for Ukraine a sham and a violation of the rules of war. The Donetsk People's Republic court found the 3 fighters guilty of seeking the violent overthrow of power and of mercenary activities and terrorism. Meanwhile, as the Kremlin's forces continue a grinding war of attrition in Ukraine's east, President Vladimir Putin appears to have likened his actions to those of Peter the Great in the 18th century, saying the country needs to take back historic Russian lands. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Finland and Sweden's bid to join NATO remains in question ahead of the alliance's summit this month. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is hardening his opposition to their joining, accusing the two countries of supporting terrorists. Dorian Jones has that story.
With much fanfare, Sweden and Finland formally applied to join NATO in May. At the time, the application was seen as a formality. But now the bid is in jeopardy. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he will veto Sweden's and Finland's applications unless they end what he says is their support of the Kurdish rebel group the PKK, which is fighting Turkish forces and which Ankara considers a terrorist group. Helsinki and Stockholm deny supporting the PKK. Finnish and Swedish officials say they are trying to address Turkish concerns. Asla Aydintashbash is a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations.
The fact is that Turkey does hold a very important card, the veto card, and I think that this is not going to be resolved that smoothly.
The United States and the European Union have also designated the PKK as a terrorist organization. Erdogan is also calling for nations to stop supporting the Syrian Kurdish group, the YPG, which he says is linked to the PKK. Finland and Sweden and several NATO countries, including the United States, support the YPG, a key ally against the Islamic State militant group in northern Syria. But President Biden could be the real target of Erdogan's hardening stance over NATO enlargement. Soli Özel is a professor of international relations at Kadir Has University.
Many people do think that the objections to Finland and Sweden are basically messages to the United States to take Turkey more seriously, to engage with Turkey, and for President Biden to, if you will, to resurrect that personal relation that President Erdogan established with President Trump.
Unlike his predecessors, Biden, who is critical of Turkey's human rights record, has largely refrained from directly interacting with Erdogan. Instead, analysts say Washington will work around Turkey's veto threat by deploying security forces with other NATO countries to Sweden and Finland, further isolating Turkey. Experts say the impasse is taking a toll on Turkey's economy, with the Turkish currency, the lira, now under added pressure. But analysts say this is a price Erdogan may be ready to pay, aware that appearing to stand up to NATO plays well with his voters. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
At the Copenhagen Democracy Summit on Friday, NATO's deputy chief said that there's no immediate military threat to both Sweden and Finland from Russia, and he is confident the aspiring NATO members will join the alliance despite Turkey's objections. Finland said also on Thursday it plans to amend border legislation to allow the building of barriers on its eastern frontier with Russia in a move to strengthen preparedness against hybrid threats. Now, speaking at the same event, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said through an interpreter action was needed to make Ukraine part of the European family.
Why? If the poll shows that 71% of Europeans consider Ukraine part of the European family, why are there still skeptical politicians who are hesitant whether Ukraine should be allowed to move to the European Union? We need to remove this gray area which is so tempting for the Russian state. We need to move to actions from the that Ukraine should be a part of the European family. In the coming weeks and days, the European Union may take a historic step that will prove that words about the belonging of Ukraine people to the European family are not just words and not empty words.
At the summit, the European Parliament President, Roberta Metsola, said that the Parliament supported Ukraine's bid to achieve candidate status. Now, granting candidate status would allow a country like Ukraine to begin negotiations on aligning its laws with the legal framework of the European Union. UN economists are warning that the war in Ukraine threatens to upend last year's recovery of foreign direct investment to pre-pandemic levels and send global investment flows spiraling downward in 2022. UNCTAD, the UN Conference on Trade and Development, has just launched its World Investment Report for 2022, and Lisa Schlein has those details.
Multiple global crises have seriously dimmed prospects for sustaining last year's strong recovery, which saw global FDI, or foreign direct investment, reach nearly $1.6 trillion. This is an increase of almost 70% from the exceptionally low levels during the 2020 pandemic year. UNCTAD Secretary General Rebecca Grinspan says climate change, the pandemic, and the war in Ukraine have dramatically changed the global environment for international business in the last 3 months. She says multinational corporate investors are facing a year of uncertainties.
Global value chains are greatly disrupted. Consumers are worried, and interest rates are rising. Fears of a recession are high, and rising investor uncertainty will put significant downward pressures on global foreign direct investment in 2022.
The report notes last year's recovery benefited all regions of the world. However, developed economies fared much better than those in the developing world. It says FDI flows rose 134% in developed countries, reaching $746 billion, more than double the 2020 level. Grinspan says multinational companies raked in record profits, mainly from booming merger and acquisition transactions.
Overall, FDI flows to developing economies grew much more slowly than those to developed regions, but still increased by 30%. The increase was mainly the result of strong growth performance in Asia, a partial recovery in Latin America, and the Caribbean, in an uptick in Africa.
The United States, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Canada head the list of top 10 economies for FDI inflows in 2021. UNCTAD economists say the growth momentum generated in 2021 cannot be sustained. They say global FDI flows this year likely will move on a downward trajectory or remain flat. They warn FDI flows to developing countries in 2022 are expected to be strongly affected by the war in Ukraine. They say the fiscal space in many countries will be significantly reduced. They add governments, especially in oil and food importing developing economies, will have fewer resources to spend on so-called greenfield or new projects. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. The Biden administration recently pledged $700 million in precision-guided and medium-range rocket systems in addition to Javelin anti-tank rockets, radars, helicopters, and other hardware to Ukraine. Britain also pledged M270 rocket launcher systems capable of hitting targets 80 kilometers away, which its foreign office said would give Ukraine a significant boost in capability. Russian President Vladimir Putin said that any further Western deliveries of long-range rocket systems, tanks, or weapons would be targeted. Wolfgang Putzai, a military expert as well as a security analyst, discussed the possible scenarios for the war in Ukraine with VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed Elshenawi.
Russia will certainly increasingly target major traffic junctions critical traffic infrastructure, civilian critical traffic infrastructure, and storage sites in Western Ukraine. Eventually also the bridges, the main bridges over the Dnieper River, which is going north to south, separating the country in east and west, to prevent these weapons from reaching the front line. Russia's overall intention is to encircle and totally annihilate the Ukrainian forces east of the Dnieper River, to occupy at least the whole Donbas, the easternmost part of Ukraine, and to establish the preconditions for further advance along the coast of the Black Sea, to take Ukraine's last seaport, named Odessa. Based on this, I see three potential scenarios. One, Russia succeeds with this plan in the Donbas decisively and is able to make Ukraine a landlocked country by occupying also Odessa. Two, a continued war of attrition, which eventually allows Russia to seize most of the Donbas, but without achieving a decisive military victory. Three, Ukraine is able to launch a major counteroffensive and regains most of its territory. I would say the second scenario is the most likely one. Speed, amount and quality of Western weapon deliveries and the availability of trained Ukrainian military manpower will be key elements for deciding the outcome of this war.
Before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russia conducted a strategic nuclear exercise as a deterrent to the West. Russia has the largest nuclear warhead stockpile in the world with almost 6,000 warheads. About 2,000 out of that number are tactical nuclear weapons. Could Russia resort to such tactical weapons?
One must not forget, Russia has vital strategic interests in Ukraine. It does not only include what they consider the protection of the Russian minority, but also economic access to the Donbas, which was once the heartland of the Soviet Union's heavy industry. If Ukraine would succeed with a major counteroffensive and wipe out the Russian forces in Ukraine, which is very unlikely, this would directly harm vital strategic Russian interests. And this means it could be the case that Russia uses a few tactical nukes to prevent a total defeat and to force a negotiated favorable ceasefire. This is what the Russians call escalate to de-escalate, a scenario they are also practicing in their exercises. While, as I said, it is unlikely, such a scenario is unlikely, I would nevertheless strongly advise that the West seriously considers such a scenario and evaluates its consequences, including the own response.
Wolfgang Putzai is a security analyst and military expert. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed Elshinawi. Russia has bombed Ukraine's infrastructure, blockaded its ports, and reportedly has stolen its grain. Much of the world, and especially Africa, rely heavily on Ukraine's wheat exports. Ukrainian ministers have also accused Russia of stealing up to 500,000 tons of wheat since mid-March. Hassan Kanenji, director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies in Kenya, says Africa is faced with a choice of what he calls international political moralizing and solidarity with the Ukrainian people on one hand and starvation of its people on the other. Kanenji says it's not a hard choice. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that he would not be surprised if some African countries have already purchased stolen Ukrainian grain from Russia.
When it comes to that, I think it's a difficult place for the continent to be, but I think the choice will be much easier because in the absence of an alternative to plug in the shortfall, I do not think, expecting African countries not to be able to entertain the idea of Russian grain will at the very least be unrealistic.
Well, is that to say that you think African countries that are with people that are very much suffering at this point, some of them close to the brink of famine, you're saying they don't really care where it comes from? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, Africans don't really care where they're going to get their food from. And this is particularly so because there is no alternative that has been offered thus far to try and to mitigate some of the consequences of this conflict. And so while on a personal level, as individuals, they may care about the plight of Ukraine, I do not think, given a choice between saving their lives and expressing solidarity, someone who is, of course, in foreign land, it's going to be a fair choice. They are still going to be able to choose to survive. And so there is no clear policy or rather stated policy that is what is going to happen. However, if that opportunity is availed, I think African countries are going to take it.
as far as you know, has this already occurred? Have any African countries purchased grain and wheat from Russia since the war began?
Right now, there's no information on any known quantities of supply that have come thus far. Perhaps because of the impediments imposed by the challenges of the conflict, that's part of the reason that informed the kind of visits of African leadership to Moscow to try, number one, and unlock the grain supplies that accounts for close to half of Africa's grain needs. Thus far, we don't have any information that there is grains that have reached the shores of Africa. But neither will I be surprised if actually that has happened or that is going to happen in the near future.
Put it another way, do you know if Russia, if any of the Russian diplomats that have already relationships with African countries, have they reached out and said, do you want to buy this?
I think considering the conflict context and the geopolitical nature of also this conflict, even if that were to be the case, I do not think it's going to be publicized. But I will not be surprised if that has happened, in part because Russia also, not only does it need allies, they need to be able to sell some of its own stockpiles, you know, out to other countries. And so I think to expect that African countries, they are going to be as enthusiastic, especially with the sanctions regime, as perhaps much of the West, is not only unrealistic, it is a little bit naive.
That's the director of the Horn International Institute for Strategic Studies in Kenya, Hassan Kanenji, speaking to my colleague, Carol Van Dam. U.S. officials also say that they are working with Ukraine to export at least 3 million tons of grain to combat the world's growing hunger crisis, especially in Africa. And finally, to his millions of followers, Ukrainian YouTuber Anton Petushkin may be best known for his travel videos featuring mountain roads and seascapes. Now he's using his platform to tell people in the West about life in Ukraine during the Russian invasion. Reuters' Angela Johnston rounds us out.
You cannot be confident in your security, so these things are terrifying, actually.
Ukrainian YouTuber Anton Petushkin began documenting what he saw when Russia invaded his home country. It marked a change from the glossy travel videos his millions of followers are used to seeing.
I'm just a travel guy. I was not into politics at all. But on 24th of February, politics ended. This is not politics. This is actually war. And people are dying. And of course, you cannot be silent. You have to say something.
First day of war, you totally mixed up.
He chronicles daily life in the capital, Kyiv.
From my apartment, I decided to move to a safer place.
And says his specialty is personal, emotional stories, like the moments he shares with his mother. He said he initially tried reaching out to his Russian audience with two videos.
They gained a lot of views, but I mean, the effectiveness of this video was really, really small.
So he switched his appeals to people in the West.
There's democracy in the West, and people, I don't know, maybe they can watch some of my episode and ask their elected officials to maybe to help Ukraine somehow.
As of Thursday, his video about life under the siege had nearly 1.5 million views on YouTube.
You have to do something, because this is your country, this is your homeland, this is your city. I mean, your friends, your life is here. This is important for me, and I hope this is important for someone in the West also, because they can understand what it feels like to be in the country that are fighting with the enemy in 2022. It's madness, actually.
And we thank Angela Johnston of Reuters News for bringing us that story. And on that note, that's going to do it for us this week. Don't forget, there's additional updates at voanews.com. And on behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.